Hi, everybody. Welcome to Booktales with Randiga and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature David Ebenbach, author of What's Left to Us by Evening, published by Horizon Books.
Booktales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a drink while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a cozy idea. Today, we are drinking the Dark Cherry Tree, inspired by David's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
David Ebenbach is a writer self-described as an author chronically preoccupied with the human condition. A deep thinker and a multi-talented scribe, he is the award-winning author of 9 books, including novels, short story and poetry collections, and books of nonfiction. He lives in Washington, D.C. with his family. His latest poetry collection, What's Left to Us by Evening, is what we discuss today. That and his latest novel, How to Mars, are available now. Of What's Left to Us by Evening, author Dana Roser says, David Ebenbach's poems in What's Left to Us by Evening are funny, engaging, kind, generous-spirited, moving, clever, even childlike. It's almost easy to forget he's writing again and again about a worldwide pandemic, a bitterly contested election, earth-threatening climate change, in short, the apocalypse. In this book, Ebenbach talks to us in such a way that we can't help but look. He hits all of our world's pressure points in a simple, straightforward, yet wholly imaginative and unforgettable fashion. Wow, fabulous praise.
How does one live in a world that is both beautiful and broken, a world of cherry blossoms and gun violence, fellowship and political enmity, plague and rebirth? What's Left to Us by Evening, David Ebenbach's unsparing and timely new poetry collection, examines the obligation and privilege of caring at all. The wide-ranging influences on the poems in Ebenbach's third collection include Judaism, the Asian poetic tradition, the natural and built environments, and current events. It's a beautiful collection, and we are looking forward to discussing it with him today.
How are you doing today, David?
Well, after hearing that, I mean, pretty good. It's really nice when people say nice things about your book. And I'm grateful that Dana characterized the book in that way. And it's a lovely sunny day in a city that I live in, D.C., which is actually a very beautiful place. So I'm good. And I'm really grateful to be talking to you two.
Great. Yeah, for sure. Well, we're really looking forward to talking with you about your work and having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. In a way, I think of it as sort of the victory lap. Writers, we just sort of hang out in our rooms, working on our stuff and hoping for the best. And it's also sort of speculative and who knows what's going to ever happen with any of it. And then you come out of your cave and there's some people there who want to hear some poems. That's amazing. So I do love giving public readings.
Yeah, very neat. I find that when I give readings, it's kind of a trip because it forces me to refocus on the topics I was thinking about while I wrote that book. But I'm always surprised which pieces of the book that readers take away or enjoy the most. Do you ever find you're surprised by that?
Yeah, I'm surprised by lots of things when I give readings. I'm surprised that someone's nice enough to let me read. I'm surprised at the things that people really respond to. I'm also surprised by what I respond to. There was a reading the other day on poems of struggle and solidarity. And I read some poems about gun violence and some poems about anti-Semitism and white supremacy. And I got really kind of agitated and caught up. And when I got back to my seat afterwards, my wife sort of grabbed my hand and held it really tightly. I don't think either of us expected that I was going to get quite that overcome by reading about these things, even though obviously I was impassioned enough to write about them. But you'd think once they're written, they're sort of inert, right? But they're really not.
Yeah. And not only that, but when you're writing it, you're writing in like a quiet room sometimes and you're in your own space. But when you see other people's faces reflecting their emotional response, that can give you an extra impulse of wow, right?
And when you're reading it too, your voice and the feeling that you put into it makes you feel, I think, a different way than when you're just putting the words from your head to the page.
Yeah, it's really true. It's a different thing than looking at them with your eyes or even making them happen with your fingers. It's a different thing giving them voice.
Yeah, for sure. I'm interested in your collection and the different parts of it. And I'm kind of curious, how did you decide on the structure of the book? And if you could talk a little bit about your process for choosing and organizing the poems for this collection.
Yeah, I don't know how common my process is or how good it is, but it seems to be what I do, that I write poems in no really systematic way, just sort of whatever I feel like writing about, and they just pile up. And eventually it seems like there's enough of them that maybe there's a book there. Maybe there's enough of them that there's two books there, for all I know. And I just go picking through them to see if some of them want to be together. They make sense together. So for example, my last book, Some Unimaginable Animal, came out a few years ago. Many of the poems that are in my current collection were written at around that same time as poems written for that collection. But those poems wanted to be in that book, and these poems wanted to be in this book because of the themes that they circle around. The last book was sort of about physical life, being a body in the world, hungers, appetites, things like that. And this current book is really about what for me is a central conundrum, which is that the world is really broken. Society feels really broken. Climate, all sorts of things feel sort of shattered to me. And at the same time, I'm constantly confronted with how beautiful it all is. The way that we are with each other, the kind of the love that we show for each other, the cherry trees in Washington, D.C., the sky, community. How is this all possible at the same time, this violence and this gift? And the book is really centered around that. The first half of the book is particularly about the brokenness, and the second half about the beauty. But of course, it's hard to disentangle them, so they often happen at the same time.
Yeah, I can totally see that. And something that particularly inspires me about you as an author, and it's probably because I love it when I find people who are playing in multiple genres like I do, is just that there's so many different ways something you feel or want to express can come out. So I wanted to ask you in particular, because you're a writer in many different genres, what inspires that moment where you say, okay, it's coming, it's here, where you need to write a poem or a story or whatever you're working on. And maybe you could just speak to, in general, what's your writing practice? When do you do it? How and why?
You know, one of the things I love about doing interviews like this is that sometimes there are sort of recurring questions. Maybe I'll hear it. Maybe there's an interview 4 years ago where someone asked me this question and I get it now and the answer's changed a little bit.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, on the one hand, I can say what I think I've often said, which is if I'm really caught up in a moment or an image, a poem is likely to happen. Whereas if I'm really interested in a character or a sequence of events, a kind of a story, then fiction might happen. And that's still true. But I also think it's about sort of who I've been hanging around with.
You know,
and I never thought about this before until you just asked me just now, that if I've been reading a ton of poetry, I get this kind of, ooh, I want to play feeling.
Yeah.
Right? Right?
And for sure.
Right. And so a poem comes out. And could that have been a story if I'd been hanging out with a bunch of short story writers? I mean, on the page, you know, when I'm reading, maybe. I don't know. I will say that sometimes I have solved a problem in a poem by realizing it needed to be a story and vice versa. So my first guess is not always correct.
Yeah. See, I can see how that would happen too. And I don't know if this happens this way for you either, but for me, whatever book I'm writing is teaching me what I need to be writing.
Totally.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. So when you're trying to figure out what your idea wants to be, can you also talk about a little more specifically how short stories or how other essays or other things inform specifically your poetry?
Yeah. One of the arguments for writing in multiple genres is that you can learn about genre A from writing genre B. I think that's a really important thing. So a poem, maybe it's about a moment, maybe it's about an image, but I still feel like on a certain level, something needs to happen. Maybe it happens in the reader. Maybe it's not an event that you write about, but that there's some sort of a shape of movement in reading a poem. And stories remind me that something has to happen in a poem as well. And poetry reminds me when I'm writing a story that every single choice matters, that punctuation matters and capitalization matters and exact word choice and repetition and rhythm, that all of those things matter. And so they have a lot to teach each other. And in fact, I think stories and poems have a lot in common. I think novels are really different from both of those things in a lot of ways. I'm not sure, I've written a couple of novels, but I'm not sure I really understand them.
I agree. I think the short forms all have a lot of similarities that the novel does not.
Right?
Yeah.
There's something about a poem and a story where if you Okay, so here's this philosophy I have, that if you're writing a novel, you sort of believe that you need to accumulate a lot of stuff to really make something big happen. That if you want to get to this final scene, that there has to be a lot of stuff before that to make the power come out of that final scene. Whereas with short pieces, poems, not the Iliad, but like a, you know, short lyric poem or a short story, for me, there's this feeling of like, if I look really closely at one thing, everything else reveals itself. And it's so different, those two philosophies. So that's where I think the poem and the story hang together in a way that the novel is doing a different thing.
That's so interesting.
You know what I really love about what you had mentioned earlier? You had said basically that your answer changes through the years to certain questions.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because I feel like I would have echoed exactly what you said about short stories until I did this professional program in screenwriting. And then it gave such a kind of an instructive element of the breakdown of plot points that now, as I wrote a screenplay and then a novel based on the screenplay, it was like the plot points became the short story that was turning into this huger interconnected series of beads that became a novel. So I was kind of seeing more interconnectedness, weirdly, to that. But I can see that some people would feel that too, because writing literary novels, which we both work in literary, can feel like a lot more freedom in terms of the plot structure. But by the same token, what a trip, right? To suddenly see something in a different frame via the vehicle of a completely different genre.
I think that's really true. And this is a great podcast. And one of the things about podcasts like this that's amazing is there's a kind of optimism that surrounds them, like this hope that writers can talk about what they do in a way that's sort of true. And the fact that my ideas change all the time about what I think is going on with my process and my work makes me sometimes hold that idea lightly. Like, I'm not sure I actually know what I'm talking about. But we want everyone to know what they're talking about because we want to learn how to do it too, you know?
Yeah.
So it's complicated.
But you always know what you're talking about exactly right now when you're saying it. It's just that it might change 10 minutes later. You know, it's like that Alice in Wonderland thing, right? Something different could occur by morning or whatnot. About this collection in particular, something that always fascinates me about different projects I'm working on is that there's always different things about them that I'm really grooving on or enjoying. Mm. About this collection in particular, can you tell us some about what your favorite part of writing this book was, the most interesting thing, and maybe the part you liked the least in the process?
Yeah, this may feel a little counterintuitive, but I like writing about things that are very difficult for me to think about. I often try to write towards discomfort, my own discomfort, not necessarily the reader's, but there are poems about violence in here. There's poems about moments of despair. There's poems about confusion. There are all these poems about cherry trees blooming, partly because I just don't understand how something can be that beautiful and how we can see it every year. It's staggering to me. So I love writing about sort of places of breakdown in me and confusion and tension. And so this book does a lot of that. I mean, this book is really about some of the things I'm struggling with the most, I think, including the beautiful things. The hard part for me is always, this is much more mundane, but I can't stand revision, quite honestly.
Me either.
Thank you. It's so painful. It makes me want to actively weep. So
same.
It just.
But how close to done does your stuff come out? Do you feel like the longer you're writing, the more things come out of a piece? Or is there a different feeling with different works? How does that work?
Well, yeah, I think you nailed it there, that it's different with different works. I think it's very rare that something comes out quite close to being done. I think all of it needs some work, but it varies just how much it needs. There have been poems where I've had to practically blow them up and grab a couple of lines here and there and work around those for something to happen. You know, there's this probably apocryphal story about a workshop where a workshop leader was talking about one of the students' poems and saying, "This is a fantastic poem. Love it. All you need to do is to cut all of the lines except line 18 and then write around that." And it's like, it's so interesting to think that it can be a great poem, even though 35...
There's only one usable line in it.
Yeah, because that line was so on that that's actually a meaningful thing to say. I don't know if that really happened, but sometimes it's like that with a poem where there's only a couple things in there, but they're so exciting that you have to stay with them. And then other ones, it's more like tidying up and tightening and fixing, but I don't enjoy any of those. Any of that.
I am with you. I will draft all day long. Just never let me have to revise. I really love the recurrence of cherries and cherry trees or cherry blossoms in many of your poems. And I really enjoyed Essays on the Cherry Blossom. That was one of my favorites. Yeah. I'm wondering what draws you to those flowers, that images, either in your life or as an image in your poetry.
That's one of the things the book is trying to figure out. I don't even totally know. And it's not simple at all, because it's not like I never saw a cherry tree before in my life, or at least I assume it isn't. But when I moved to DC almost 12 years ago, it was as though I'd never seen one before. And I think it's because they're everywhere. You know, just in my neighborhood, in front of the school that my kid went to for elementary school, there's just several cherry trees. Just in back of my building, there's one. They're just around. And there's something about, number one, when you get under them, sort of everything disappears. They create this really astounding canopy that's kind of cloud-like over you, and the rest of the world kind of vanishes. And when you're a little bit later in the season, by which I mean 3 or 4 days later, some of the petals start snowing down. So then you're surrounded on the side, all sides, by this experience. And it's as though you've traded one world for another one. And it just takes my breath away. But I think there's even more to it than that, and that I can't totally get at what it is in the temporariness, the fragility, or maybe it's the resilience. I have a poem in the book about how I thought this March cold snap was going to destroy the cherry trees and we wouldn't get the blossoms, but then they bloomed anyway. And what is that? How are we fortunate enough to get that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in my image repertoire, when I'm reading so many cherry trees, for some reason, it's evoking hundreds of years of Japanese literature as well. Sure. So it's like there's all of these wonderful disparate things that are occurring simultaneously. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
As you're reading about the nature. So, and also in several of the poems, I really liked how you were talking about the difficult part, but the most enjoyable part being kind of essentially writing where the blood is, right?
Yeah. Well said.
And so in these poems, I really enjoyed the contrast between nature and man's destructive nature, but also the analysis of man's motivations. So one of the most poignant poems in the collection for me was the one that was called Your Enemy's Father, where the narrator has essentially failed to connect with his dying and difficult father. And he speaks of an enemy who becomes himself reflected. But I also felt like there were poems in this collection with more themes of life being mirages or relative, like Double Rainbow or My Dream in Japanese. And so I was wondering, is part of the goal with this book to kind of examine our subjective reality in relationships?
Wow. That's an incredible question. And I think I may be learning right now that that is the case. You know how you don't totally know? I mean, I think
it's
there when you start talking about it. It is there. And maybe that for me is part of what's difficult about certain things like these blooming trees or snow or the sky, rain. I'm really obsessed with rain. And part of it is that I'm not sure what it's doing to me, and I'm not sure what I'm seeing and who I am seeing it. And I also, this goes to your the way you started. I'm an urban person. I grew up in West Philadelphia, and we didn't have a lot of trees, actually. But I think I'm most interested in nature, where it intersects with human construction, that the contrast for me is really powerful. And it's not always ugly when there's that contrast. It's also, it can be quite beautiful to see the petals of a cherry tree on a car windshield, for example, or running along a curb in the rain. So that contrast is really important to me for sure.
Very cool. I'm also interested in how it's like there's all these things going on at once at the same time. And one of which is your work is also approaching religion and spirituality, kind of intermingled with this modern landscape contrasted with the nature. Does one inform the other?
Yeah. Well, or more than that, it's hard for me to really take any of it apart. That for me, for example, my Jewishness and my writerness are kind of the same thing, that they're both ways of trying to make the universe make more sense and to find the meaning in the universe. And they inform each other. And I think one of the things that's powerful for me about my Jewish experiences is how wordy they are and how full of poetry they are. And then one of the most powerful things for me about writing is how transcendent it feels and how it takes me to places that theoretically you might only encounter in certain buildings that have been marked as spiritual places. But I don't think we should obviously limit ourselves in that way. So there's a tangle there that may not even be a tangle so much as a unity.
Yeah, for sure.
David, can you tell us how this book fits in with your author trajectory?
Well, there's a good question. I don't know if I have an author trajectory. I think my agent would like me to have one for sure. And I'm not sure that I'm doing a very good job of having a trajectory. I'll say this. I often am trying to write the thing that I don't know how to write. And that shifts across time. You know, at the very beginning, it's like, I don't know how to write a poem at all of any kind about anything or a short story. And then you sort of learn to do a few things. And then it's like, well, what else can't I do? And part of that is formal, like what kinds of moves can a story or a poem make that I don't know how to do yet? But part of it is also emotional, like what have I not faced in myself that I don't know how to talk about or in the world? And so I think, for example, with my last book, Some Unimaginable Animal, my last poetry collection, I mean, I had to face some things about just physically being in the world. And some of that's kind of funny. Like I just think food is incredibly delicious and can't get enough of that. I don't know if you guys have had it, but it's so good. You should try food.
You know, I need to go out right now.
I'm putting that on my list of things to do today.
They have it in a lot of stores, so you can get it.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I love how you have this mixture of levity and depth.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Thank you. I think there you go. That's another example of this that I think for a long time I thought, well, you have to be very serious to be serious. And I think that humor is serious. I think anything where you're going at the world with a lot of openness and earnestness is serious. My early stuff, I think, was not as interested in humor because I was maybe a little bit afraid of it. Also, I was insufficiently therapized and medicated. And so the depression was guiding my hand a little too much, I think. And now that I feel like I have access to a wider range of emotions than I used to, I like to bring it all in. So that's kind of the arc for me. Partly it's been about getting access to more stuff inside and outside me and within the writing tradition and creating new traditions if possible. And it's also been about just always finding something I don't know how to do and trying to figure out how to do it. And that's what keeps it alive and interesting for me.
Along with our conversation about things being relative and shifting, as of right now, I wonder what is your favorite poem in this book you'll read from today and why?
My favorite poem in this book.
Keep in mind, you can change your mind tomorrow. This is just for right now.
Well, exactly. And I was going to say, this goes exactly to what we were talking about before, that I think there's a kind of a mood thing, and it's more volatile even than what my answer is to the question of writing in multiple genres, that if I'm feeling that something is really, really hard and that I'm not able to see the world fully, I might say that Beauty Studies would be my favorite poem, because that's a poem about me really struggling to absorb beauty. And then there are other times when I'm full of awe on the other end of the spectrum, and The Season for It, which is all about sort of the endless blooming of DC, that would be my favorite poem. Or me sort of feeling like I want to try to start to talk about some of the beautiful things, and then the poem Falling would be maybe my favorite poem. Or that I'm caught in between and I don't know what to do, and then maybe Double Rainbow. So it's a very moody thing, I think, for me.
As is writing in general, probably, huh?
Yeah, for sure. Right.
Well, fascinating. We are very much looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from the book today. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called Dark Cherry Tree. We're calling it that because of a line in one of your poems. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make one and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 5 or 6 cherries pitted and cut in half or quarters, 1 ounce of lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of agave, and 2.5 ounces of champagne. You muddle the cherries, agave, and lemon juice and strain it into a glass with ice and top with champagne and garnish with a cherry. And if you're looking for a mocktail, you substitute alcohol-free champagne. It's really light and delicious. I hope y'all enjoy it.
David, would you like to tell us a little bit about the pieces you've selected to read today?
Well, first, let me say, how delicious is that? How delicious is that? And how cool is it to take something that's in this verbal register and make something resonant in a that you can taste? I just think that's beautiful. And I think what you two do is beautiful. So thank you.
Thank you. That's so sweet.
Yeah. Well, it really is meaningful to me. So thank you. Well, I'm going to read, a few poems from my collection, but I always feel a little more comfortable if I start by reading somebody else first. And so I'm going to read a poem by Maggie Smith, which I think speaks to this central issue that I'm wrestling with of beauty versus brokenness and how we handle all of that. And it's in her collection, Goldenrod, and it's called The Hum. So this is by Maggie Smith. The Hum. It's not a question without the mark. How do we live with trust in a world that will continue to betray us? Hear my voice not lift at the end. How do we trust when we continue to be betrayed? For the first time, I doubt we'll find our way back, but how can we not? See how the terminal mark allows a question to dress as a statement and vice versa. Sometimes if I am quiet and still, I can hear a small hum inside me, an appliance left running. Years ago, I thought it was coming from my bones. The hum kept me company, and I thought, thank God for bones, for the fidelity of bones. They'll be there until the end, and then some. Now what? How to continue? I've started calling the hum the soul. Today I have to hold my breath to hear it. What question does it keep not asking and not asking, never changing its pitch? How do I answer? So that's Maggie Smith. And now I have the unenviable task of following Maggie Smith. This poem of mine from the collection is called Plague City, and there are a few poems in here that were written during the COVID era towards the beginning, and this is one of them, Plague City. From the window sometimes I see a person walking a dog. The dogs have to walk no matter who's sick. They are energy compressed. Sunlight leans on them and their nervous owners. After two long weeks I go out because I need to go out. To the cherry trees. There are a few people and dogs out here, and I duck them all, around cars and signposts winding up the hill, two blocks of sunlight. Then the cherries, clouds, fields of cotton, a reversal of something, a surrounding, which is to say that they have bloomed heedlessly, wantonly, with determination. They spray the air white, pink. It's almost like they don't need us. This next poem is called The Weekend Before the Election, also during the COVID era. A lot of poems about elections in here, because of course that's one of the ways in which we see the brokenness of the country the most vividly. The Weekend Before the Election. The jack-o'-lantern fills with bruise-colored fur, and I bag it for the shoot. Days ago, we finished off the seeds. Afternoon settles. Tonight, we'll gain an hour, more of a year that we want to give back. We go out driving, see the decorated houses. There are a few kids in costumes in the pre-twilight, out for candy bagged individually. My family is the most family it's ever been. We are a container in the world. After the drive, I make dinner while my wife hides candy in obvious places, because why make it hard? Tuesday is slow at the corner of the week. The yellow-streaked pumpkin we didn't carve because it was pretty sits firm on the windowsill, seeming not to change. In that poem, there's a kind of dread about what might be coming. And at the same time, it's really true. You know, my family is the most family it's ever been. It really was actually in some ways a kind of beautiful time for my little family, my wife and my son and me, that we got really close during that time. So things are so complicated. This poem is called Election Night. This is our country, gathering on couches to see how our country is going to turn out. Each person has a drink and maybe some rules for drinking it, the kind of food you can put in bowls, hold in your hands. Somewhere else, people are standing in line for last chances. Then the polls will close and they'll yield up their numbers, which count our accumulated trust. On the television is a map of the country, which we've come to accept. The way we accept all the pictures of all the things we've never actually seen. The atom, black holes, our neighbors' good intentions. are neighbors who brought their secret lives into their own secret booths and made choices we won't ever know for sure. Which is what will be left when the bottles and bowls are empty. These people, these mysteries. For now, we watch as states choose colors like shirts and pants, like anything that covers the body. One of the interesting things for me about the election poems in this book is that they're from multiple different elections. This one was before the pandemic, but they point to a schism in us that has not changed very much over time. This next poem is called Ode to Anger. You are an old friend, if not a very good one. You hang out at my ear recommending blood. Or your hands, extra hands on the wheel, steering me through the guardrail or into the wall, and then throwing the gear so I can back up and hit it again. Not that you're outside of me. You're more like a tide in the brain, carrying bad ideas, each one a sealed bottle to smash. Then you're the friend who bolts, me alone with a hand of shards. At night, when things could be quiet, you return to hammer together a stage on my pillow, and rehearse revenge tragedies where you get all the lines. In geometry. In geometry, we are each segments in that there are two points and we exist between them. Unless we are rays and don't know it, which are born and go on forever, because you can't know there's a second point, not for sure. And the nice thing about rays is that the infinity on one side makes the finitude on the other impossible, which would mean we're lines with earlier beginnings than we knew. Well, no beginnings, without origins or point of destination, just the line extending. State of the Union. Well, snow falls. The slow kind, spiraling down in the orange floodlight off the apartment roof at an angle. The air's on the move out there, air that hurts on bare skin, but we're inside with the flat screen. Turn to the side and you can see dimly the president declaring on the glass of the window, pale blue quadrilateral that almost swallows up the flakes that tumble into it. But not quite. They're still there, working with the cold and the wind, unhurried on their winding way down to earth, to the parking lot's bright windshields, to, ready at the foot of the building, the waiting grass. First day of spring. There is a beauty that engulfs, that replaces the morning. No sun on the sidewalk, no air to breathe, and the early mist held in place as if by hands, but not mine, not me. Gone. Not my slow morning thoughts. Gone. With the row homes and me down to the footprint. Gone. Barely holding on to even the words. Cherry blossom. Cherry blossom. Cherry blossom. And then finally, I think I have an answer to your question now, actually. I think I'm about to read you my favorite poem in the collection. I didn't realize it until I saw it. Saturday morning. Despite everything, sun finds the synagogue window. Despite everything, stretches into the sanctuary, whitening the white walls, polishing the wood floors, touching shoulders and hair with warm hands, finds us gathered from our many daily exiles, already singing. And I'll stop there.
Wow.
Those were wonderful. I loved all the ones that you chose. They were so good.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really cool to feel the answer bubble up to your question.
That was really excellent. And I hope more readers engage with all that's deep and luminous in what's left to us by evening and go buy this book. Do you have any new projects you can tell us about? What comes next in your enormously creative pipeline?
Well, thank you. I am working on short stories, for one thing, and they seem to be speculative fiction. So they're all about all sorts of things, but again, usually about things that confuse me and surprise me about the universe. So I'm working on those. And then there's a novel that I'm hoping is almost done as well. And then who knows what's coming after that?
Wow.
That's pretty exciting, though. That's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like plenty.
Yes. So what advice would you offer to new writers?
I think, okay, new writers, here's what I would say. First of all, nobody else should tell you what you should be writing about or how you should be writing it or who you should be writing to or why you should be writing. Those are things that you really ought to discover for yourself and ought to follow pretty passionately, and that you shouldn't take no for an answer along the way. I think the folks who get their voice out there are the folks who are not good at taking in the word no and who are pretty determined. So be prepared to hear some people pushing on you and be prepared to keep moving.
Yeah. And speaking of keeping moving, I love the idea of calling out of names, of giving credit to influences of other writers from the past, bringing their glory into your work or giving influence. So who do you think are the writers who have given the most to your poetry and other genres?
Yeah, you mentioned the tradition of Japanese poetry, and Basho is both sort of spiritually and literally in this book, where he gets quoted a little bit. So sort of the master of haiku has been an influence on me, certainly. And there's also been a ton of folks in American poetry. I think the people who rise to the top for me right now are Ross Gay, who writes about complicated joy better than anybody, and also Jane Kenyon, who writes about complications, I think, better than anybody. Those two folks have been incredibly powerful for me in my poetry.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really enjoy talking with you and hearing you read your work. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. This is an amazing thing that you're doing. Thank you.
Yay, our pleasure. And everybody, please order What's Left to Us by Evening, this wonderful poetry collection. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Booktales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Booktales. See you next time.